Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening from wherever you are. I am Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. And today's guest, I'm a little biased and subjective when I say this. So I remember when I was getting ready to make my transition out of Connecticut, and I was wondering where to go. And Dr. Sean Nelms, right? He is the impetus to why I am in Rochester, New York. We had a great long conversation, and it just felt right, right? The academic academia up here in Rochester, second to none. We have steadfast education leaders like Dr. Sean Nelms in the Rochester area. And I said, hey, I'm going to make the plunge. And when I told Dr. Nelms I was moving out here, big smile. Just happy to have me out here, and he welcomed me with open arms. But let's forget about that. He is one of the, I call him a legend out here in Rochester, but he is one of the most remarkable education leaders, a superintendent, but transitioning into a new role at the University of Rochester. So it is with absolute honor to have my brother here, one of my personal good friends, a Rochester legend. When we talk about being legendary in the space, we always strive to be like this individual. I welcome you, Dr. Sean Nelms. Dr. Nelms, how are you, good brother?
Man, great. Thank you for that warm and exaggerated introduction. I appreciate you, though. No, Rochester is a great place, and welcome to the Brain Trust. I think it's important when you can bring talent like yourself to an area, then use that talent to create new leaders. It provides a more vibrant and more active and more intellectual community. So you being part of that is only going to add to what we started some years ago. And yeah, the work here at East and work here at Rochester, which we'll talk about in a sec, has been some of the most rewarding experiences that I've had as a leader. I think it has made me a better person. It's grounded me and understanding the moral purpose of my work and what I want to bring to a community, more importantly, how the community has brought itself to me. And that bi-directional nature of community becomes critically important. I think we had to think about that bi-directional aspect, even in leadership, when we're leading in these complex school settings, that no longer can we think about school transformation as a single heroic figure coming in and creating all these systems and structures and then walking away and things are going to sustain itself. That never works. You can't point to any model in any country or in any industry where a single leader came in and fixed a problem and it created lasting change. What you do see in thriving communities, if it's industries and education or otherwise, is a sense of organizational coherence that's built within a system that allows individuals to be bold and to be authentic in their work and in their process. So I'm excited about that and excited to talk more about those opportunities and things that we've done here and the intersection between that work and your book.
Absolutely. And Dr. Nelms, I just want to be your Dwayne Wade or Chris Bosh to LeBron James from the Miami Heat. And of course, I want to be your Scottie Pippen, where you're Jordan.
You won't be Scottie right now.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, let's take that back. Old Scottie. Right. Oh, man. No, Dr. Nelms, Sean, I tell you, I want to say thank you, man, because, you know, like I said, you were one of the main reasons why I came out to this area. The fabric of education, the leaders that are out here, and especially with your voice, you know, now as you moved out of the superintendent role from East into this great new role at the University of Rochester that we're going to talk about. But I want to say one thing. Congratulations, author. Author. Okay, we're going to get into that and talk about your book. Dr. Nelms just released a book. It's called Leading with Purpose, Empowering Others to Create Sustaining Change. I apologize. And that is a book you need to get into your hand. We'll talk about that later in the podcast. But Dr. Nelms, let's get into the podcast because I'm ready for this conversation. You know, we have these type of conversations to my audience. We have these type of conversations over lunch, breaking bread together here in Rochester, home. And everybody loves Rochester up here, and I can see why everybody talks about it, specifically when you got leaders like Dr. Nelms in the community. What is there not to brag about? So, but Dr. Nelms, leaders across the country know your work as superintendent, or was a former superintendent now in Rochester, New York, and in the academic research element at the University of Rochester. But what equity song defines Dr. Sean Nelms? And when Dr. Nelms walked into a room, and I'm telling you, I've seen you walk into a room, and it got weight to it, right? But when you walk into a room to give a keynote or provide a lecture at the University of Rochester, what song immediately comes to their mind?
Man, that is a great, great question. I wasn't anticipating that. I'll tell you that I am like unapologetic. So you say, talk about intentionality, being bold, unapologetic. I have grown into my unapologetic self, where when I was a young leader, I would often kind of dismiss parts of my past or who I truly was. I thought I had to be this mythical figure, you know, that led schools. Now I just lean into who I am, and I am a hip hop junkie, and I'm a huge Jay-Z fan. However, I'm gonna go with Kendrick Lamar on this one, and I'm gonna say the song DNA.
Yeah.
From the lyrics itself to the beat, you know, it's when I walk into a room, you know, head back, shoulder back, chest out, DNA is just in my head, you know, because it's symbolic to not only where we are in our space of leadership, but where we've come from, and the importance of knowing that, you know, we are who we are because of those who came before us.
Absolutely.
And it's our obligation and responsibility to create leaders for the next generation. And so within our spirit, within our DNA, within our mental construct, we have to think about ourselves in every space as one who's willing to lead with and for others.
And Dr. Nelms, when I'm just capturing this, when I think about Kendrick Lamar and that apologetic spirit, I always I reference back to Meek. That's the alignment to that. So, but that's just but me personally. But yes, you know, when you talk about this assimilation, right? Assimilating and losing our identity within this as we get to or as we go through the stages of leadership, knowing who we are, right? Becoming apologetic with our stance and our approach and how we concretize that stance, whether it be grounded in equity, excellence, how we're providing opportunities for, I like to say, the historically excluded student groups. These are the things that we have to be able to exhibit and have to be able to show the next set of leaders, like you talked about. But DNA, that song is
that's it.
Sean, that fits you perfectly. Oh man, you want to talk about organizational coherence?
Right.
Coherence to the depth. But again, Dr. Nelms, congratulations on your book. All right, Leading with Purpose, Empowering Others to Create Sustainable Change, just came out, hit the market.
Right.
I know it's going to be a bestseller. I know it's going to be able to make change in the education ecosystem. But for our audience, and including myself, who just going to, with the book just came out, what is the book about? How is it about transformation? And how will it impact leaders and their practices?
So the book itself is so new. I actually gave you the wrong name because I changed it. It's Leading with Purpose, Empowering Others to Create Lasting Change. And so I went back with sustainability and lasting intentionally because, you know, it was important that they mean something similar in terms of the ability to sustain. But I saw lasting as the ability to not only have be sustained in that space,
right,
but for the leader, it allows them to use that in other spaces that they enter.
Absolutely.
So I didn't want sustaining to be confused with the work that you created in a school or in a district, but that as a leader, it's lasting within you and your ability to then create other opportunities and networks of support. So I'll do it again. So it allows people to create other networks of support through using that lasting frame. So the book itself it's my journey, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You think about going back to the song DNA. I begin the book talking about how equity was realized in my own household. I grew up with siblings, three siblings, and there was a time in which my sister, who was a junior in high school, and my brother, who was an eighth grade student in a different school. My brother went to a magnet school. My sister went to a traditional public school. And they came home one day and pulled out the same math text. Mm-hmm. So my sister was given the same math book as my brother in eighth grade. Caring parents, caring household, you know, demystified that. You know, do they care? Do they care about education? We had a very education forward household. But the school system itself had made a decision that some kids in some schools would be going to be giving math texts as juniors, as some kids in another school who were going to have them in eighth grade. So the system itself was starting to make a conscious decision of dividing kids based on what they thought they were able to achieve. So it wasn't my parents, it wasn't wealth, it wasn't our community. It was a school system itself that was sorting and selecting students. And why I remember that day so vividly is we were so competitive. We would sit at our kitchen table. Someone came home with grades. We all pulled them out. Like, we wanted to know who's got their grade on the top of the fridge, who's going to be on the low at the highest scores. Like, it was our own competitiveness in a very positive way. Right. And that was a moment where I realized that we weren't, no matter how much we wanted to achieve, there were powers to be that were making decisions on our behalf that would set us up for life, going to higher education organizations, or some kids are going to go right into the workforce. Like, the school system was designing outcomes for kids, and that was very concerning to me. And so the book starts kind of framing the importance of understanding equity is a systemic issue. Mm-hmm. The middle part of the book goes into school reform, because I think it's really important for us to talk about all the efforts locally, at the state level and federal level, of people trying to reform schools. And I make the argument that even with the best intentions, school reform is a failed attempt, because it de-emphasizes the importance of leadership in those systems. Mm-hmm. And so we transition from the word reform to transformation, because transformation implies it's happening with a community and not to it. And then I make the argument that even with the best laid plans, you have to create a sense of interpersonal accountability within systems, where people own the success and failure equally through a distributed lens or distributed leadership model. And then I go through some very practical examples of how I had to apply that evolution to my job as a school principal, as a teacher, as a superintendent over the years. And I use a lot of examples of where I didn't, when I was not successful, examples where I may have failed. Because I think effective leaders are those that are humble. Yeah. They express a sense of humility, and they're willing to share that with the next generation so that they don't make those same mistakes, or they're prepared for what's to come. And so that is the evolution of the book. It's really a journey that will prepare any type of leader in any industry to think about their obligation to build the next generation of leaders after them. So at East, you know, this is a school system where when I entered 8 years ago as superintendent, the graduation rate was 29%.
Yeah.
It was the lowest performing school and the lowest performing district in New York State. Yeah. And 8 years later, the graduation rate surpassed 85%. Yeah. And that wasn't because of me. It was because we created a system that was built around coherence, particularly with addressing some of those instructional gaps that you talk about in your book. And so we really thought about designing a school with the community. So no plans were written until we met with the entire school community and asked them, what do you want to see in a school system? And after they gave us their input, we went back and aligned that with theory, aligned that with practice, and then created the strategic plan for the school that would last over 10 years, that would allow us to incrementally address the key levers to success. And that's what we've done. So the book talks about that. It doesn't talk about the school as much because I wanted to de-emphasize that. It is not my job to tell the school story. It is the school's job to tell the school story. Yeah. So I just gave a glimpse of how I experienced it as a leader within that learning process.
Absolutely amazing, Dr. Nelms. And I can tell you to my audience, right, when Sean took over East, yes, it was at 29% graduation rate. You should see East now being a part of this community, the leadership and the distributed leadership model that Dr. Nelms implemented, empowering community members, empowering his key stakeholders and practitioners at East. It is a school that you it's a desire to go into, you know. And Dr. Nelms, congratulations on such a successful tenure as superintendent. But one of the things that I really want to unwrap, right, for my audience is that the consideration that you took in empowering people, providing that level of empathy, design thinking 101, right? The first that, and going back and iterating and developing your plan based on that. The stories and the examples within Dr. Nelms' book, it brings it to life of how to actually implement it and how to actually look at specific strategies and customize, right? Customize to your contextual environment within leadership. And Dr. Nelms, thank you. That book, I'm telling you, yes, Sustaining Lasting. Yeah. When I went to lunch, everybody, this is the reason why I'm saying it. When I went to lunch with Dr. Nelms, right, this was a couple of weeks ago, it was Sustaining. I don't know it was actually changed to Lasting, but the context that Dr. Nelms provides, it just strengthens the actual artifact.
I think words matter, right? Absolutely. And so I think, you know, I'm careful not to talk about school transformation as being one that's more reforming, right? So some people say, you know, it's reforming, it's a transformation, it's a transforming. And I think reforming has a negative connotation.
I can
because it, you know, and so I wanted, so I really tried to be careful in how I used the words, because I did not want to misrepresent the community that I serve.
Absolutely.
And so the entire context of the book, the entire context of what I try to do as a person in who's fortunate to be in these spaces, is to make sure that when I'm representing the work of others, that I do it respectfully.
Absolutely.
And I do it in ways that capture their investment in the change process. And you'll never see me to be the person on stage saying, I, or get my book, this is what I did to East. It's really an opportunity for me to acknowledge the teacher leaders, the teachers, the parents, the kids, the administrators, and the impact they had on me as a leader. That's the second half of the book.
Absolutely.
That, you know, if you think about distributed leadership, it's really an actionable process. Mm-hmm. And so if it's actionable, that means it involves many, many converging thoughts and ideas. And so how do you represent the entire movement without representing all those people who poured into the work? And so I hope that this book is respectful of all educators to know that although you may be the person doing lesson plans in the classroom every day in second grade, how you taught that kid and the skills that you put into and poured into them is impacting them as high school seniors when they're graduating.
Absolutely.
And that our kids don't just move on and forget what we taught them and what we poured into them, that education is on a continuum. And so if you're going to build a systems change and systemic change, you have to talk about it as a continual system of iteration. And I think that book does it. Your book does that. Like it's unapologetically does that. It talks about the cyclical nature of the work and how important it is for us to revisit and to iterate over time. And I don't think we've had those conversations in schools long enough. I mean, even the policy issues that, you know, like APPR that wanted to, you know, judge an individual teacher's performance, it ignored what that kid experienced years prior. And it also ignored the impact of that work for future years. So the evaluation wasn't a bad thing, but it was too specific and concrete, particularly in New York State, because it did not account for the evolution of the work over time. And so I really think we need to demystify, you know, like academic success and academic outcomes by thinking about it on a continuum within a system, as opposed to judging the independent and individual aspects of teaching, learning, and assessment. And that's what that book talks about. That's what your book talks about. And I think that's where school transformation conversations are headed. I can tell you in research, those are things that we've been studying here at East, is making sure that we look at this problem from both a qualitative and a quantitative lens. Yeah. And the qualitative lens allows us to understand how people are experiencing the transformation process, how we can improve that in other school contexts. So I'm excited about that. So my mind is constantly moving between theory and practice because I really see the convergence of that happening here at East.
And you are one of the true academics, Dr. Nelms. And I love your differentiation between reform and transformation, right? And I just want to just underscore what you stated about reform, because it's completely true. In the BC stage of education, when we look at a lot of the national and even local state reform initiatives or school reform in depth, we only saw segments of that of the reform strategy being impacted by it. And when we only saw segments of it, we saw the gap, whatever gap we want to focus on, access gap, opportunity gap, exacerbate itself, because the reform strategies or the reform attempt through policy, even at the federal level, I like to say, caused this explicit and implicit segregation of schools, segregation of students as well. But really, like now, as we move into the AC stage of education around transformation, and there's a lot of connectivity between my book and your book. And again, congratulations with that. I know the academic component in both of us really wants to unwrap what academic success and outcomes look like. But I want to highlight your new position, man. Congratulations on your appointment as Vice President of Community Partnerships at the University of University of Rochester.
That's right.
That's right. University of Rochester, right? In our home of Rochester, New York. So now, based on this, right, you are also a clinical professor of educational leadership at the Warner School in U of R.
That's right. That's right.
So, but for my audience, what will your new role look like at the University of Rochester? But more importantly, because you have been so steadfast and important in the K-12 sector, how will you continue your work in the pre-K through 12 landscape of education?
You know, it's interesting. I was reading your book and I was on chapter 7, The Excellence Loop for Cultural Transformation. Mm-hmm. And in that chapter, you talk about collaboration is necessity for success, excellence and access were a priority, and it takes a community to raise a child. And I think that the University of Rochester as an organization can lean into those same principles as well. I think we have a ton of examples of success at the university that the community has no idea about.
Right.
And so we work in isolation. We have to understand that the communication of what we're doing is important. At the same time, there are needs in the community that the university may not be aware of because there is no direct pipeline or pathway between the community's needs and the university's research or a university's commitment to the community. So how do we build a bridge between that? And when I say community, I don't just mean Rochester, New York. U of R has a national, international community as well.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to be an anchor institution in this community, we're the only institution that actually is within the city limits. Most of the other ones are on the outside in suburban or rural communities. Then we have an obligation and responsibility, an obligation and a responsibility to make sure that our work mirrors the needs of our local community as well. So examples of that would be in education. I'll still be a part of that. It won't be my main job. But if this partnership with the State Education Department for East is to continue, it has to be a process that is agreed upon between the university, State Education Department, and our local school boards. So I'll help support that. At the same time, we are an R1 institution, Research 1 institution, and also have the most aggressive and progressive, I would say, medical facility in the country, but definitely locally here. And so, you know, when we have issues of behavioral health or trauma within our community, to what extent is the university responding in ways that are proactive, but also supportive of the crises in the moment, and then providing opportunities for families to heal and move on later on in life. So the medical field, if it's the eye care or dental or emergency department, we have responsibility to support the community in ways that that our services can support the healing of that community. If you look at there's other aspects of like education itself, not just from a K-12 space, but we also prepare future teachers and administrators and counselors for the work ahead. So what lessons are we learning at East that is changing the curricula within our academic programs, not just in education, but psychology and philosophy, whatever those things are? There's an opportunity for us to learn from this community to strengthen our presence, but also it's an opportunity for us to use things that we do really, really well to strengthen the community also. So it'll be creating a bi-directional relationship between Rochester and the folks that we serve.
Amazing. Amazing, Dr. Nemes.
Yeah. Big job, man, but I'm excited about it.
I tell you, when I heard that you had got the job and we talked, minimally about it during that time you were with that transition or about to be announced, completely happy for you because the vitality, right, of your practices, your grounded knowledge and work around research and in the academia world, this is just broadening your scope and broadening your work to have bigger impact and influence on a community that just loves you to death and that just, prides on your work. So congratulations.
Thanks.
You are, man, I tell you, it is definitely an R1 school. a lot of geeking out here in Rochester. Yes. And that is one of the things that I love about this community. But we were at lunch about a month ago, right?
Uh-huh.
And since you're in the academia world, I know that there's a lot of people that ask this question.
Okay.
And what your perspective on this, because this is, I like to say, this conversation happens a lot now, right? And this is regarding teacher prep programs and leadership prep programs, right? And you, being a former superintendent, know that there's this misalignment or this disjunction between the students that are matriculating in public education. 54% are Black and Brown, but our teacher and our leadership preparation programs are not really grounding and rooting practices of culture responsive practices, right? Preparing teachers around culture responsive pedagogy, but more importantly, leaders, how they're metabolizing and redefining structures and systems so that it is more culturally responsive to our student needs. We see that disjunction, right?
Yeah.
Talk to me, Dr. Nelms, about that. How do we universally address that preparation issue at the university and college level if we know that our student demographics are going to be the outlier of how we're preparing our teachers and leaders today?
You know, I could say we're fortunate in that this is a university partnership at East. It's when we're in our eighth year. And as I said earlier, this partnership is bi-directional.
Right.
So as much as we've gained from the university has gained from us, meaning the city of Rochester and its residents and students. And so the only way that the university here was able to change its curricula was it being engaged in the community in ways to know what needed to be changed.
Right.
So by our professors volunteering in the school day, co-teaching classes, they started realizing that, we're not preparing our students for this environment. And this environment does not mean, it's not a negative connotation.
Right.
So some would say, we got to prepare kids differently or teachers differently to go into teaching the city as compared to the urban and suburban. No. You have to be culturally aware. So whatever environment you walk into, because it will be Black and Brown kids in rural areas and suburban areas and urban settings. There'll be kids who have intellectual limitations or disabilities in urban, suburban, and rural. So the pedagogical aspect of what we do in college should be that we prepare our students to enter any of those school environments. What we've done is, historically, not just University of Rochester, but school prep programs, and we have prepared teachers to teach to the top, period. And everything else is an other.
Right.
And so we have totally revamped our curricula at the University of Rochester in our ed leadership program, in our teaching program, in our counseling program, because we had some context within East to understand what really needed to be done. And that's why our graduates are leaving better prepared to do this work. So the solution, I would say, is any school, college, university that is certifying teachers or administrators, I would argue, must have an established relationship with a school within its community. And I'm not saying just placing student teachers. I'm talking about getting in there and make sure they have an established partnership with those schools so they can better understand how their curricula should mirror the realities of their local communities.
Absolutely.
And I think that is a very inexpensive adaptation to what we do. as universities, I think it is just a commitment. It's a commitment to the community rather than seeing the community as potential, potential funding opportunities for the school by, you know, come to our school and take our classes and pay to come take our classes and be on our campus and pay more for parking and then come on campus and not only pay for parking, but also pay for your diploma, right? So we almost become, at times, communities can become a funding model for schools of education, as opposed to the schools of education understanding that their commitment and their obligation to be an anchor institution within those communities and being intimately involved in the work that that they're doing. So I know it's a lot of words there, but I honestly feel like that's the disconnect. The universities really aren't anchored into the community in meaningful ways, and therefore the curricula only reflects what they probably created years ago and when they established the standards for their academic programs.
Absolutely. And Dr. Nelms, I really appreciate you saying that universities and colleges becoming or being committed to the community, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Of that community. And so important, I would consider that as an economic and educational imperative, where universities act as anchor institutions.
Yes.
And
yes.
Redefine or define what that commitment right. is, so they have a better understanding of who they're preparing and how they're preparing teachers and leaders to engage in, I like to say, high quality instruction, high quality mm-hmm. educational experience for Generation Z, Generation Alpha, yeah. the antithesis of what you and I and our educational experiences. But I consider you, Dr. Nelms, a czar in the context of aligning capacity from a systems lens. Brother, I'll tell you this, man, I just love just coming just next to you, talking to you, because it's always how we align, or that organizational coherence that we talk about from an alignment standpoint of capacity and systems, right? And continuous capacity building, we know, should be research-driven, should be shared, differentiated, and leveraged to improve new pedagogical strategies or practices, or even new structures and systems for innovation and equity. Now, when it comes to andragogy, yes, Dr. Nelms, I pulled out the word for you.
I see.
When it comes to andragogy, i.e. adult learning, how do leaders build meaningful professional learning models for all tiers in alignment to the new strategy in education to promulgate innovation, excellence, and equity for all?
Man, you know, that's a great question and a shameless plug for the book, because that's what the book is geared to do. I mean, it really is talking about adult learning in the sense of, if you're going to be leading organizations, first you have to know yourself as a leader.
Absolutely.
So I think we often put people in positions that perhaps they're not ready for or trained to do. And then when they aren't successful, however you define success, it's a surprise to everyone. And I'm saying we have to pour as much energy into developing our leaders as we put into developing the minds of our students. Because you have to be able to understand the conditions that you're in and how to navigate. So in the book, I give an example of two leaders that I had at East. Okay. One, I call my ready, shoot, aim administrator. Because great ideas would just do it and then fix it later on. When you do that, you create a ton of mistakes, right? You have another one was like really structured, almost type A, you know, I need to have all these questions answered before I hit go. They happened to be on the same leadership team. And it was always a constant conflict between the two of them, both having the same goal to create a quality education for themselves and for their students and for the adults in the setting. But they had two very different approaches. And so as a leader, I had to navigate, massage that conflict and make them understand they were going for the same thing. And then the conversation we had was not, why don't you like one another? It was, how do we utilize your skill set around being organized with your skill set of seeing the big picture sometime days before the issue occurs? And how do you create some synergy between the two of you that doesn't de-emphasize one skill set over the other, that doesn't minimize someone's passion, but really creates the maximum effort between the two opposing views? And once we had that conversation, like, things started to click, and they better understood how to serve one another. Why is that important? Because they had teachers they were going to be supporting, right, who had that same conflict between a teacher and perhaps their supporting special ed teacher, who it wasn't that they each wanted better for students, but their classroom was chaotic because they had two different styles of leadership. And so when I think about leadership in that context, it's our responsibility to make sure that the folks that we teach as superintendents, the folks that we nurture as leaders, as superintendents, are able to lead other leaders, teacher leaders, student leaders in the future, and not do it in a way that minimizes a learning style for one group, but emphasizes it for another. And so that's what I'm really, when I talk about organizational coherence, I'm really talking about the human investment into people, knowing who they are as individuals and who they are as thinkers, knowing what they're able to do, what they're ready for, and then creating a system that accounts and accommodates all of those different personalities and learning styles. And I think those are successful organizations. It's not the organizations that have everyone act like they're the same type of thought leader as the person who has the title of CEO. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so that's the type of work that I would highly suggest we talk more about. And as leaders, and we stop pretending that, you know, that the success of an organization is solely dependent on the superintendent, if it's an education or a CEO of a major company. They may create a quick spike in performance, but that's not sustainable or lasting.
Sustainable or lasting. I was thinking, going back to those two words, sustainable and lasting. But Dr. Nelms, wow, what an answer! Because when I reflect right on that, and what I think a common misnomer is that when we think of organizational coherence and alignment, we think about the hardware, i.e., structures and systems, ensuring that there is fundamental alignment or rooted alignment within the systems and structures that we're building. But you look at it from this inverse, where organizational coherence is from the software. A lot of aspects that are not underpinned in education, human investment, thinking about each individual as they think, as being critical thinkers of the organization, assessing the readiness, right? Are they ready for that position? I mean, if you think about it, the correlation, right? From that is we can substitute adults and put students in there.
Right. Yes.
Really ground our classrooms in the way that you're grounding, or you suggesting in your book and what you just highlighted, grounding that to be a part of the organizational strategy to create coherence.
Yeah. So then when they get the hardware, they're ready for it.
Absolutely.
Right. There's nothing more frustrated than to be given something that should work and you can't get it to work. And the first thing that you say is, well, it's not me, it's what they gave me, it's the hardware.
Right.
And so, you know, often our plans don't get implemented because people don't understand the why.
Correct.
They move right to the how. And I think that's very dangerous. I think when leaders have a community of learners that are stuck in the how, then those systems don't last. I would much rather spend the time developing the why and understanding the why and unpacking the why. So when we get to the how, people can then take their own individual talents and skills and be able to process in ways that make the how work, make the hardware work. And so I think that's a critical misstep in education is, you know, we have the pressure on one hand to say, if I don't do it now, these kids are going to fail.
Right.
So I have to just like, I got to push through this to get to the kids right now. But that's looking at it through a myopic lens. Like, this is just my kids for this second grade class. As I said earlier, if we think about it on a continuum, then we give ourselves some space and grace to say, I know I didn't cover this critical skill in second, but because I know the continuum, in third grade, they're going to have 5 weeks on this. And when I pass this student on to the next grade level within our systemic continuum, it's my responsibility to say, here are the critical skills these kids did not do well on. And could you please emphasize this when you start? Don't assume they know it because they didn't get it at the end of second grade. But if you think about it on a continuum, it creates an opportunity for the information sharing to happen from year to year, teacher to teacher, administrator to administrator. And so when you think about the academic journey of a student, you think about from a pre-K to 12th grade continuum, then the school system itself can say, we serve this child well.
Absolutely.
Right? You can't say that if a kid has a great second and third grade year because an individual teacher and there's no systemic plan, and then it goes off the rails fifth through sixth, seventh, now the kid's dropping out in ninth. And then you say, well, it's because that ninth grade teacher didn't teach them well enough. That's unfair. Right. The system set that kid up for failure from the moment they stopped having a highly effective teacher. That's when the failure began, not when the teacher at the end had to pick up the pieces. So that's I think that's important for us to think about on that continuum. I think that's where you establish that excellence loop.
Absolutely.
Because it's cyclical, right? Year after year, it's intentional, right? It's not performative, right? It's not where, yeah, we're a great school district. It's not saying that we're good. It's proven that we're good by the outcomes of our students and our staff and their feeling of a connection and commitment to the work that they've been tasked to do. And that's where that interpersonal accountability comes into play.
Extraordinary articulation of it, Dr. Nelms. I tell you, those micro tenets, specifically when we bring up the excellence loop for level setting purposes, absolutely that continuum. I concur with you 1,000% because what you just described, Dr. Nelms, is what I like to say Daniel Kahneman's work around system one, system two.
Yep.
System one, that 5%, how? That spike, that increase, yep, but the continuum. Is that systems to thinking. Perfectly described. And to my audience, please rewind that last statement or the sentiments that Dr. Nelms highlighted, because again, it is a fundamental shift when we think about transformation, not from the systems one lens of grounding hardware, where the expected output is going to be this acceleration of student achievement or student outcomes, but that systems two lens around this level of creating organizational coherence, focusing on the software piece. I can't wait to dig into your book, man.
Yeah,
I'm going to reference it back and forth. You know, listen, we got a lot more lunch meetings coming up now. You don't want me to read that book, man. I'm going to have you at lunch 4 days a week. But
I would tell you, so it's funny, you know, I joked, I was in my head, I'm like, I gave way too many words. This is how we talk at lunch. So if you are listening to this podcast, like, this is not performative. This is how Mike and I get down. Like, this is just, we're going to sit, we're going to have a little something to drink on the side, and we're going to talk about the work, right? And it's in a way that, like, sharpens. I mean, literally, I got your book. I sent him a picture the next day, my feet up, reading it, and notes all over it, right? It's just, it is an incredible book that makes you think outside of what we've been taught in your traditional teacher programs, administrative programs. It's not what you would typically see in a conference that you attend, right? Like, this is a different level of thinking, but I think it's aligned with where our kids already are.
Absolutely.
Like, your book, being intentional is a critical first word, right? That's
exactly.
Critical.
Exactly.
That means that there's thought behind what you're
yes.
going to do, right? It's not reactionary. Being bold means that when you're in a system that was created by people who are still in it,
absolutely.
You are going to create massive waves when you try to change it.
Absolutely.
So being bold requires you to be able to lose something in an effort to change it.
Absolutely.
You don't lose your soul in that process. Losing your soul is not being bold. That's
right.
Being compliant. Right.
Preach.
That is not in our DNA. We are not passive people. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Being unapologetic. That means you're coming and being authentic.
Exactly.
I'm going to be who I am when you hire me.
Exactly.
And when you fire me.
Exactly. Dr. Nelms, I'm telling you, I'm ending the podcast because right here, I got Dr. Nelms saying intentional, bold, and unapologetic, and given the theoretical meanings and underpinnings of that. Brother, I appreciate you. And yes, to my audience, this is what we do. We go to lunch. We're there probably for about 2 hours.
Too long.
And we are talking about every aspect of education because what they say, sharpens. Literally, you know, I learned so much from Dr. Nelms, man. I mean, just sitting there, just talking. The next thing you know, oh, we got to go, man. I'll call you later. We'll talk and all that. Dr. Nelms, it's an absolute honor. To be a founding member of Upstate New York APSE with you, my brother. And starting this, you know, was something that we always talked about. And now, you know, getting it up here, finally having a charter in place and really getting the work done You, myself, along with 8 other founding members, looking to expand that. That's going to be great work, right? We have a lot of new work, a lot of good work to do with NAPC as they support us. But a previous guest on VFV, Dr. Christina Kishimoto, somebody we love Dr. K.
That's right.
Presented a strong, albeit true notion that national organizations must do more for educators and leaders that are facing immense polarization in their district. What is your stance regarding national, state, and local organizations supporting these leaders, even when they transition out of the executive role? If this is going to be the new normalization in education or for organizations at the local, state, and national level, how can they deepen their support when leaders are not the quote-unquote hot ticket of the time of their time frame?
Man, I mean, I think that quote is so timely because so many of us, like myself, like yourself, realize that some of the pressure and stress that happens in P-12 schools, education is becoming so aligned with politics that we're no longer CEOs of school systems. We are CEOs of the political animus, school systems, local politicians. Somehow the kids will continue to get lost in that process. Teaching and learning will continue to get lost in that process. So I would say national organizations must reintroduce the purpose of schools. Reintroduce the purpose of why we're here. We're here to create the next generation of thinkers and doers. And anytime that the adults limits what they're thinking, i.e. culturally responsive education, i.e., you know, whatever those things are within those state contexts, then we are limiting what they're thinking. The moment that adults get in the way and start to dictate what should be happening in schools, we're limiting what they're doing. So our job is to not indoctrinate kids into doing anything, but to give them a well-rounded education that prepares them to enter the world in whichever way they see fit. And what's happening from a political standpoint is that we are limiting what kids are thinking and doing, and there's no other voice, i.e. national organizations, that are creating a sustainable and transformative narrative around this work. So when I think about the national organizations, you take one that, let's just say an organization that represents all superintendents in the country, right? When they shy away from culture, when they shy away from conversation around culture responsive or anti-racism education, because some of their constituents are in states where that's not popular, then that's a problem.
Exactly.
Because by not saying anything, you're limiting the states that are ready to take on those conversations. So national organizations, they have to be bold. They got to be willing to lose something, even if that means a small percentage of members. And we have to know what they stand for before we start to sign up and follow them. There are organizations that I no longer give my membership to because they have not taken a strong stance on anti-racism.
Absolutely.
If it's something that they punt around and they talk around, I'm not trying to give my $300 or $400 a year, you know, to that organization for them not to take on the issues that matter most to me and my school community.
Absolutely.
So I'm not saying we have to create these siloed communities or these siloed conferences or these siloed, you know, organizations, but we have to hold these organizations, you know, feet to the fire and say, you know, to what extent are you really positioning yourself to protect your members in ways, like a union, to protect your members in ways as they fight for what's right and just within their school systems?
Absolutely. And Dr. Nelms perfectly stated because, you know, Dr. Kishimoto, she elaborated on the same concept that you presented, where national organizations has to take a stance.
Yep.
And when they take that stance, specifically some of the organizations around the country taking that stance with equity when it comes to this level of anti-marginalization and anti-racism in schools, yes, there's going to be a few members who are going to leave that organization, but you're taking a critical stance for the dominant population, which is 54% of our students are Black and brown.
Right.
So we have to be able to take those critical stances around some of the most contentious topics that we're seeing in education, both and unapologetically. So, Dr. Nelms, last question, brother.
Yes, sir.
Last question. Take it as it is. Everybody answer this question. They go beyond the three-word limit. Some education leaders that I know that we know, right? They follow the rules, which you think they're going to break the rules.
Right.
Think how it is, brother. What three words do you want today's audience to leave our podcast with regarding leadership, equity, and innovation?
No single heroic figure. That's four.
I got it. Elaborate, please. That's all right. But listen, I had some guests up here do 3 times 3,000 words.
No, what I mean by no single heroic figure is that leadership is actionable and involves the input of many. And I think it really starts with a foundational investment in the why. Why are we doing this work? You know, what is our intended outcomes? And then you move into the how, and then you monitor those outcomes. And I think that's just critically important. You can't do that alone. The real story, the root causes will never be unpacked if you're the only one telling the story. You need students, former teachers, administrators to really give you the historical context of why you're in the situation that you're in. Schools don't fail because they're designed. Schools don't fail because they want to fail. They fail because there were historic decisions that were made or decisions that were made historically that minimize their ability to be bold and to be unapologetic and to be intentional. So you got to first know what those, you have to ask the question, what happened instead of what's wrong. When you ask what happened, it gives you historical context of that environment. When you ask what's wrong, you're really only talking about the now.
And Dr. Nelms, I appreciate that, you know, especially when you said leadership is actionable, and it's completely true. And to my audience, I think that, you know, there was a lot of great information, ideas, methodologies, tactics that was presented here. But take this, right? Investment in the why and monitoring the how, right? I think that there's a perseveration on the how, but forgetting the why. So if we just take that, the why to the how, that's like the old foundational switch from the rigor to relevance framework, right? Rigor, relevance, relationships, where now it's relationships, relevance that will lead to rigor. The why, investing in the why, will lead to this how of defining excellence, innovation, leadership, and equity in our schools. Dr. Sean Nelms, it is an absolute honor, pleasure to have you on VFE. I'm selfish. I got you about 10 minutes away, so I'm extra happy about that. But to my audience, Dr. Nelms, if they want to get in touch with you, how would they be able to do that?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Dr. Nelms. Also, my consulting group is nelmsconsultinggroup.com. That's probably the best way to follow what I'm doing. But Twitter, I'm active on there, always posting positive things like the work that you're doing and some of our other colleagues. But I'm not hard to find. You just say, Google me. No, I'm just saying, I'm not hard to find.
And to my audience, if you ever come up to Rochester to see Dr. Nelms,
come on.
Hey, I'm about 10 minutes away.
Yeah. If you want a 2-hour lunch and hear us talk back and forth, then come join us. Come join us.
Dr. Nelms, it is an absolute pleasure. I know I'm going to see you probably next week or the week after. We're going to finalize something to get together. Congratulations on the book. Sincerely, cannot wait to dig in that. Now that you have my book and I'm going to be reading your book, we might be together for about 4 or 5 hours.
That's right.
Thanks so much, Dr. Nelms. And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.